English Radio. Coming up is the news.
An imprisoned senior member of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement is on a hunger strike for 2 weeks. Iran calls for immediate international action over Israel's acts of aggression against Syria. And North Korea tests fires an intercontinental ballistic missile. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Today marks the 15th day of the hunger strike by a senior member of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement held in Israeli jails. Hatter Gadnan is protesting against the extension of his solitary confinement. The 44-year-old was arrested during a raid on his home near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin earlier this month. He has been arrested 12 times by Israel and spent nearly 8 years behind bars. More than 7,000 Palestinians are currently held in Israeli jails. Resistance movement Hamas has vowed to continue its support for the Palestinians languishing in Israeli prisons. Hamas says the Israeli regime is subjecting the detainees to the most brutal forms of abuse. Israel has recently stepped up its crackdown on Palestinians in protest at the atrocities. Palestinians have launched a general strike in occupied Al-Quds and several West Bank cities. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, says Kader Adnan has staged a number of hunger strikes to protest his detention by the Israeli regime. She explains why Adnan has now staged his new strike, which is open-ended.
Israeli soldiers had arrested Palestinians. Kader Adnan engaged in a number of hunger strikes in the past. Every time he succeeded to force the Israeli forces to end his illegal administrative detention in order that he stops his hunger strike. When he reaches literally verge of death, he ends his hunger strike after the Israelis, of course, stop his administrative detention. This time, he opened hunger strike the moment he was detained. Up till the moment, the Israelis are keeping him under administrative detention. If every, let's say, 2 weeks, they would be renewing his detention, and then they might give him a lengthy time that could last for years under the so-called administrative detention. So this is why this time he's again being engaged in an open-ended hunger strike in an attempt to force the Israelis either to prosecute him and tell him what are the exact charges against them, if there are any charges against him, or to end the administrative detention and release him.
Thousands of Israelis have flocked to the streets for a seventh straight week to denounce judicial reforms proposed by the new far-right cabinet. The protesters gathered in front of the Knesset in Tel Aviv, waving flags and placards. The reform bill is currently being debated in parliament and inching closer to approval, but the plan has triggered protests with people hitting the streets for weeks to express their anger at what they call a fascist cabinet. They believe the proposed overhaul would fatally undermine checks and balances, and if approved, the law would limit the powers of the top court to overturn the cabinet's decision. Well, Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Israel has carried out a new airstrike on Syria, targeting the capital Damascus with missiles. The attack left 5 people, including a soldier, dead and 15 civilians wounded. The Syrian army says Israel targeted several residential buildings, but most of the missiles were intercepted by the air defense. Iran has condemned the attack. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani slammed what he called the West's shameful silence over repeated violations of Syria's sovereignty. He called on international organizations, especially the UN Security Council, to take immediate action. Kanani said the subsequent Israeli and Daesh attacks on Saturday and early Sunday show the natural and inherent bond of the two terrorist entities. He said that comes at a time when Syria is reeling from the recent devastating earthquake. Palestinian resistance groups have also condemned the Israeli attack. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali. Also, we have with us Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, joining us from London. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. So, Marcus Papadopoulos, it is not the first time, obviously, it won't be the last, but still the UN keeps silent and Israel continues attacks on the civilian areas, residential areas, not to mention that even military targets would not be justified.
Well, at a time when Syria is reeling in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake that struck the country, in which thousands of Syrian men, women, and children were killed, Syria and the Syrian people have been subjected to a military attack from one of its neighbors, namely Israel. The Israeli act of aggression against Syria was not just blood-curdling, but it also reveals again the brutal nature of the Israeli ruling elite. Because to kick a people when they are on their knees is utterly reprehensible and utterly unforgivable. But there is another angle to this matter. The West, every day of the week, is castigating Russia over its military campaign in Ukraine, arguing that the Kremlin has violated international law. Yet, in relation to Israel's ongoing attacks, military attacks against both Syria and Lebanon, the West has not only not condemned Israel's acts of aggression, but it has also condoned them by arguing that Israel has a right to self-defense, which leads me on to a point. The West argues, as I said moments ago, that Israel is allowed to take military action against both Syria and Lebanon out of self-defense. Well, can that argument of self-defense not be applied to the Russian military campaign in Ukraine? Because the Kremlin has argued that one of the reasons as to why it commenced the military campaign in Ukraine was out of self-defense vis-a-vis the growing NATO menace in Ukraine. So again, if Israel has a right to militarily attack Syria and Lebanon on the basis of self-defense, then can that argument of self-defense be applied to Russia's campaign in Ukraine?
That is a very interesting point that you raise there, Mr. Papadopoulos. So, Muhammad Ali, are there any reactions there regarding the attack that recently happened?
Yes, the first reaction was from the Foreign Ministry, the statement that came out, that there should be some kind of steps taken by the United Nations to end such Israeli aggression, which are threatening peace and security, regional and international peace and security. But I believe the most important reactions are from the people, from the civilians in that area, in this area over here where I am standing in Kfar Susse. Those who were sleeping inside their apartments at 12:20 a.m. local time and woke up fearing, not knowing or realizing yet what is happening? Is it an earthquake? Is it a an airstrike by an enemy? Is it a terrorist a car bomb explosion? They woke up in fear, and what happened was, unfortunately, that it turned out to be this Israeli aggression, which killed a number of civilians. So it is the reaction, I believe, of civilians to overhear the residents of this particular building, which was directly hit, who, of course, called also on the entire world to do something and stop Israel from carrying out such attacks, to do something and help Syrians get out of their crisis, to do something and force the U.S. and its Western allies to end sanctions on them and this economic siege also on this country. They have been suffering from so many issues, the Syrian people, throughout those years. And despite the fact that there has been this massive earthquake just about 10 days ago, no one cares from the international community, speaking, of course, in particular about the U.S. and its Western allies, and, of course, Israel, which just attacked Syria, attacked residential areas. It's not a surprise, definitely. But this time the attack happened in a very crowded area, civilian area, residential area in the Syrian capital, Damascus, and it was a shock for the residents here.
Thank you very much, Marcus Papadopoulos, political analyst and author from London, and our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, live from Damascus. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of the News Review. North Korea says it has launched an intercontinental ballistic missile on Saturday to confirm its readiness for what it called a fatal nuclear counterattack. The North's official news agency described the test as a sudden launching drill ordered by leader Kim Jong-un. The report said the move demonstrates Pyongyang's actual war capacity against hostile forces. The ICBM landed in waters off Japan. The launch comes after the North warned of any unprecedentedly strong response to the upcoming drills by the U.S. and South Korea. The missile test has drawn angry reactions from the U.S.
The DPRK once again launched a ballistic missile, this one apparently falling in the exclusive economic zone of Japan. That's happened before in recent months, but this is yet again provocative act by North Korea. We call on others to condemn this action, to take appropriate steps, including the effective enforcement of sanctions.
Japan's foreign minister has also called North Korea's move an absolutely unacceptable provocation. That was also echoed by South Korea's foreign minister, who is warning Pyongyang of more severe sanctions. South Korea and the U.S. have staged joint air drills involving an American bomber in response to North Korea's missile launch. Pyongyang has always maintained that it is the U.S. and South Korea that are undermining regional stability. The North says it is watching their moves and will take corresponding and powerful counteraction. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, tells us about the significance of North Korea's latest ICBM launch.
This was an unannounced order by North Korea for the firing of an ICBM for the first time in its history. Usually, an ICBM is fired with a great deal of pre-planning, and everyone knows the date and time at which it will be fired. But North Korea this time demonstrated that it is capable of making a surprise counterattack against a U.S. and South Korean nuclear attack by issuing an order at dawn yesterday, Saturday, and then less than half a day later, firing off a Hwasong-15 ICBM capable of reaching the entire continental U.S. And even though this is liquid-fueled, this ICBM could be fueled up in less than half a day. So North Korea is showing South Korea and the U.S. that no matter how many large-scale military drills they hold, they are not going to trump North Korea. North Korea says it will not allow Washington and Seoul to gain a long-term military advantage over Pyongyang.
The death toll from Cyclone Gabrielle in New Zealand has increased to 11, with thousands still missing. The fatalities increased after search teams recovered two more bodies from the hard-hit Hawke's Bay region. The death toll is expected to rise as more than 6,400 people remain unaccounted for. The cyclone hit New Zealand's northernmost region a week ago and tracked down the east coast. It has caused widespread devastation, disrupting telecommunications and causing shortages of fresh water. Roads have been damaged too, restricting access to some affected areas. Prime Minister Chris Hipkins says Gabrielle is the biggest natural disaster to hit New Zealand in a century. And Russia has rejected U.S. allegations of committing crimes against humanity in Ukraine. It says the U.S. is fueling the crises in Ukraine through supplying arms to Kiev and is just trying to justify that. Moscow's ambassador to the U.S. says such accusations also aim to demonize Russia, calling them part of a hybrid war against the country. The reaction followed comments by the U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris at the Munich Security Conference. There, she said, the U.S. has formally concluded that Russia has committed crimes against humanity in Ukraine. Also, last year, the U.S. claimed that Russia had committed war crimes in Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly denied targeting civilians during the year-long war. It has, in turn, accused Ukraine of committing crimes against humanity and against people in the eastern Donbass region. Staying with Ukraine, Russia says it has hit several sites belonging to the Ukrainian military, including ammunition depots. Kiev, on the other hand, is reporting attacks on Russian targets. Johnny Miller has more details.
After continuing to hit ammunition storage facilities across Ukraine, meanwhile, Ukraine, particularly with the HIMAR missiles attempting to do the same here in Donbass. The major fighting at the moment is around the towns of Parmut in the north of Donbass and in Ugledar. The Russians have been trying to take these settlements for weeks, even months now. But the Ukrainians putting up fierce resistance, heavily dug in, urban warfare. But the Russians at the moment seem they're trying to make some advances. The Ukrainians have had success pushing them back, and Russia now relying on its artillery to continue to try to push these Ukrainian defenders out of these settlements. We're also still expecting, it may not happen at all, a huge Russian offensive across the country. We're not sure Vladimir Putin is due to make a speech in a couple of days. But at the moment, it's the political will that's going to have to deteriorate if we're going to see peace in this conflict. NATO politicians continuing to be bombastic about Ukraine's chances, but behind the scenes, many continuing increasingly worrying that it may not be possible in the long term to continue to support Ukraine.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamul Aliha. Today, there are thousands of people across the country who are engaged in the work of reciting elegies and are mastering various techniques for attracting their audiences. This is a great phenomenon that is taking place in the country, and we need to take advantage of it. Who should use this opportunity? I'm not saying that it should be used by me, government officials, or by this person or that person. I'm saying it should be used by the country, by the system, and by the revolution. The revolution must make use of this opportunity. This revolution needs to progress. It needs to make changes on a daily basis. You can play a role in this. That is what I am trying to say. You need to spread awareness in the country about the fight against tyrants, oppressors, the arrogant powers, and corruption. The problem with what we are doing in most places is that we direct people, we give advice, and we provide reasons and rationalize, but these things are not effective. Why? Because the public atmosphere is not in accordance with what we had intended. I have on numerous occasions insisted on the work that needs to be done in building culture. What you can do is to focus on culture building.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes we may need the country to stand up to the enemy or retaliate. At other times, the country needs to pursue knowledge and science, and sometimes it may be necessary to create an environment for thinking and reflection. We need to prepare the environment for these. I've already talked about the subject of family and raising children. You can play a far greater role than the Ministry of Health and the like in this field. You can give people encouragement, insight, and hope. As you can see, one of the enemy's most important tactics today is to create despair. Where? At the core of the country's existence. That is, in the youth. It uses all kinds of methods and tricks to create despair in their minds. What you can do is to do the exact opposite. You can give hope. You can work on guiding thoughts and actions, but there is a condition. If you wish to have the honor of doing these things, the first and foremost condition is that you be concerned about guiding people. An elegist should be concerned with guiding his audience rather than earning money, fame, social status, and such things.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi visited China for an official three-day state visit aimed at building up bilateral ties. The Iranian President arrived in Beijing earlier on Tuesday as the head of a high-ranking politico-economic delegation on an official invitation by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Beijing. Speaking to reporters before leaving Tehran for Beijing, Raisi said that Iran and China have similar views on fighting unilateralism at the international level. During the trip, the two countries sought to operationalize the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement, which was finalized in March 2021 in a bid to strengthen their long-standing economic and political alliance. The $400 billion deal will pave the way for Iran's Joining the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Xi and Raisi attended the signing of 20 cooperation agreements, adding to a 25-year partnership agreement to cooperate in developing oil, industry, and other fields. The two sides signed a number of bilateral cooperation documents in the fields of agriculture, trade, tourism, environmental protection, health, disaster relief, culture, and sports. The Chinese leader said Beijing opposes external forces interfering in Iran's internal affairs and undermining Iran's security and stability. And President Ebrahim Raisi said that Iran and China are friends in hard times, stressing that further strengthening of relations between the two countries will contribute to the security of the region and the world. The visit comes amid rapid geopolitical shifts in the wake of protracted Ukraine war and the end of the unipolar world order led by the U.S. and its Western allies. China is now among Iran's top trading partners. Since 2022, the 10-month figure of trade between the two nations stands at $25.3 billion. That figure has surpassed the volume of trade between Iran and its other neighboring countries, like the UAE, Turkey, and Iraq. Since March of last year, Iran imported $12.7 billion worth of goods from China, and its exports to Beijing stood at $12.8 billion. President Raisi took office back in 2021, and since then he has tried to readjust Iran's foreign policy with a focus on eastern countries, which has come to be known as the Look to the East policy. It aims to forge alliances with non-Western countries, especially China and Russia. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. The bloc is a counterweight against U.S.-led security and economic blocs and could significantly reduce the hegemony of the U.S. in Asia. SCO member countries account for more than 40% of the world's population and contribute about 30% of the global gross domestic product, GDP. It's widely believed that Iran's close partnerships with countries like China will significantly erode Western hegemony and pave the way for a new world order.
Foreign ministers from France, Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom have followed the United States in denouncing the planned expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In a statement, the ministers said, "We strongly oppose these unilateral actions, which will only serve to exacerbate tensions between Israelis and Palestinians and undermine efforts to achieve a negotiated two-state solution. We continue to support a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace in the Middle East, which must be achieved through direct negotiations between the parties." Norwegian foreign minister also condemned Israel's plans, saying the Israeli settlement policy on occupied land is contrary to international law and must be stopped. The Israeli settlement plans have also drawn condemnation from the Arab world. However, Israel's controversial right-wing minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said he wanted to see more Jewish settlements.
"I say to Americans and Europeans, it's so worrying. This is our mission. This is our doctrine. Nine settlements are nice, but it's not enough. We want much more."
The comments fly in the face of international calls for a de-escalation of tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians after months of violence in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The international community views the settlements, hundreds of which have been built across the West Bank since Tel Aviv's occupation of the territory in 1967, as illegal under international law and the Geneva Conventions due to their construction on the occupied territories. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in
in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Hossein al-Sheikh, a senior Palestinian official, welcomed the joint statement by Western powers condemning Tel Aviv's plan to build more illegal settlements, but said action needed to be taken. In a statement on Twitter, he said, "We demand that words be turned to deeds." Hardliners who oppose Palestinian statehood comprise a large part of Israel's new cabinet, which has put settlement construction at the top of its priorities. Extremist Israeli minister Bezalel Smotrich said about 10,000 new homes are to be approved. Smotrich said he and his allies were committed to removing completely the restrictions on building in the occupied West Bank. Today, between 600,000 and 750,000 Israelis live in these seizable settlements, equivalent to roughly 11% of the total Jewish Israeli population. The Palestinians seek those territories for a future independent state. Since then, the Tel Aviv regime has openly funded and built settlements for Israeli Jews to live there, offering incentives and subsidized housing. Their statements by the Western powers will likely have little effect on the Israeli hardliners. The regime has never been subjected to real sanctions or accountability. The Israelis have never suffered any pressure, so they keep doing what they're doing. 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank since the United Nations started keeping records in 2005. Over 140 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank last year. But already this year, we are only halfway through the second month of 2023, and Israel has already killed around 50 Palestinians in the West Bank. Israel has also regularly bombed Gaza, and now, with a right-wing cabinet in place, the situation is only expected to get worse. Israel's far-right cabinet has approved the legislation for 9 settler outposts in the occupied West Bank. All settlements are illegal according to international law, but who pays attention to international law in this occupied land?
Years of war in Syria has destabilized the region, which is still suffering from an ongoing humanitarian emergency. Millions are displaced within Syria or have fled to Turkey, which is contending with high inflation and a deepening economic crisis. The earthquake unleashed widespread damage and destruction in some of the most at-risk areas in the region. A magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck near Nurdaghi in southern Turkey around 4:17 a.m. local time on February 6th. A magnitude 7.5 earthquake followed around later that afternoon around 1 p.m. local time, along with scores of powerful aftershocks. Thousands are injured and thousands more remain trapped in the rubble, and the chance of finding survivors gets narrower and narrower. Search and recovery operations continue with assistance from teams around the world. But freezing weather is hampering rescue efforts and making it even more difficult to access possible survivors. This catastrophe hit an already fragile region, which has been marked by decades of war in Syria and economic, humanitarian, and public health crises. Turkey is facing a profound economic crisis, with a collapsing currency and extraordinary inflation that hit around 80% last year, the highest in about 25 years. The quake-hit part of Turkey also hosts a large population of Syrian refugees. The economic crisis in Turkey has helped fuel a backlash against the approximately 3.6 million Syrian refugees in the country, who are already facing poverty, discrimination, an increase in violent attacks, and the risk of deportation. More than 2 million people in northwestern Syria are also at risk of a deadly cholera outbreak. The outbreak began in northeastern Syria, attributed to contaminated water from the Euphrates River, which people were relying on in part because of the water infrastructure destroyed by years of fighting. About 47% of people in Syria rely on unsafe drinking water, a potentially even bigger risk after the massive infrastructure damage by the earthquake. in northwest Syria. In particular, this outbreak was straining an already stretched and under-resourced health system, which will now also need to find ways to treat those injured in the earthquake. The devastation extends beyond northwest Syria, as the country as a whole has been overwhelmed by years of war and destruction. International sanctions against Syria are also deepening the economic crisis Syrians face. The country faces record and widespread poverty and food shortages. About 90% of Syrians live below the poverty line, and nearly 75% struggle to meet their most basic needs. And across the region, the crisis is still acute, as agencies and officials rush to find survivors in the rubbles and temperatures drop. The earthquake compounds catastrophe upon catastrophe in Syria and Turkey. It is likely to exacerbate those that already exist while creating new, unpredictable ones. The United Nations Secretary General says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has agreed to open two more border crossings to facilitate relief aid delivery to the northern part of the quake-hit country, which is held by militants. Antonio Guterres announced the development after Assad approved the use of Bab al-Salam and al-Ra'i crossings, which link Turkey to northwestern Syria for outreach purposes. In line with the presidential decree, the crossings would be open for an initial period of 3 months to allow for the timely delivery of humanitarian aid. In addition to authorizing transit through the border passages, the UN chief said facilitating humanitarian access, accelerating visa approvals, and easing travel between hubs will allow more aid to go in faster. The announcement was made after the UN Security Council held a closed-door session on the humanitarian situation in Syria following the quake. The 7.8 magnitude quake that hit Turkey and neighboring Syria last Monday has so far claimed tens of thousands of lives. The biggest part of the fatalities that have been caused in Syria have occurred in the territory which is being held by Takfiri terrorist groups. The approval issued by Assad came after the UN lamented that an anti-government group, which has been designated as terrorist by the international community, was preventing aid consignments from being delivered to the quake-hit areas in the northern part of Syria. A spokesman for the UN's humanitarian aid office said on Sunday that there were issues with approval by the group, which was identified as the terrorist outfit Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. Previously, a number of captured Takfiri terrorists had confessed to close cooperation to U.S. military forces in Syria. There have also been reports of U.S. supporting Takfiri terrorists and helping them to expand across Syria. Also on Sunday, Reuters quoted an HTS source who spoke on the condition of anonymity as confirming that the terror outfit will not let in shipments from government-held parts of Syria, alleging, "We won't allow the government to take advantage of the situation to show they are helping."
The Russia-Ukraine war is about to enter its first anniversary within days. So far, thousands of people have been killed and many more displaced. Now, after nearly 1 year, the war has turned into a bigger conflict, an encounter, rather, between the West and Russia. Many countries, including the U.S., Germany, France, and the U.K., have been fanning the flames of the conflict by sending military aids worth billions of dollars. In the U.S., there has been a long debate among politicians on whether to support Kiev in its war with Russia. Some back the U.S. support for Ukraine. Others, however, take a different stance. Among them is Congressman Matt Gaetz. The Republican lawmaker has introduced a bill which calls for an immediate end to U.S. military and financial support for Ukraine. The resolution also urges the warring sides to negotiate a ceasefire.
How much more for Ukraine? Is there any limit? Which billionth dollar really kicks in the door? Which red line we set will we not later cross?
Throughout the war, Gaetz has been critical of U.S. support for Ukraine and has previously called for an end to the policy.
I will not vote for one more dollar to Ukraine. I will not vote for one more piece of materiel to Ukraine. We are far too entangled. in this conflict. I believe we have extended this conflict. And I call on the Secretary of Defense to declassify the Inspector General report on the compliance with our existing regulations regarding chain of custody with materiel going to another country.
Gates has also taken a jab at President Joe Biden. In a statement on his resolution, Gates said President Joe Biden must have forgotten his prediction from March 2022, suggesting that arming Ukraine with military equipment will escalate the conflict to World War III. He added America is in a state of managed decline, and it will exacerbate if we continue to hemorrhage taxpayer dollars toward a foreign war. We must suspend all foreign aid for the war in Ukraine and demand that all combatants in this conflict reach a peace agreement immediately. Gates' resolution has so far received 10 co-sponsors, including Andy Biggs from Arizona, Lauren Boebert from Colorado, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, Anna Paulina Luna from Florida, Thomas Massey from Kentucky, and Mary Miller from Illinois. The bill introduced by Gates notes that the U.S. has already authorized over $110 billion to spend on the war in less than a year. The resolution comes after a series of escalations of U.S. military aid, including M1 Abrams tanks. It also comes at a time when Ukraine is seeking fighter jets from the U.S. and its allies. Each escalation risks a direct clash between Russia and NATO, which could quickly spiral into a nuclear war. But where does this rising U.S. opposition to continue aid to Ukraine come from? If U.S. taxpayers knew that half the income tax dollars that they sent to the Internal Revenue Service every year was being spent on weapons, war, and war preparation, political support for such programs might significantly decline. As a matter of fact, no agency of the federal government communicates to taxpayers how Congress spends their money. Purchasing weapons and military services with taxpayer dollars has always been, and continues to be, a highly profitable endeavor for defense contractors. But it is in a real war, like as in Ukraine, that such profiteering truly thrives. President Joe Biden's budget proposal to Congress for 2023 included $813 billion for the Pentagon and military expenditures. This is more than half the income taxes citizens send to the federal government each year, and a more than $31 billion increase over the already bloated fiscal year 2022 Pentagon budget. It is also more than the defense budgets of the eight next biggest military spenders put together, including Russia, China, and India. One of the components of the $782 billion Pentagon budget is for the purchase of new nuclear-armed submarines, even though the U.S. already has 14 lethal Ohio-class submarines, each capable of launching 192 nuclear warheads. Canceling two of these unnecessary and provocative new weapon systems would save more than $10 billion. All in all, what seems to be a non-negotiable is the U.S. taxpayers' money, which could and can be allocated to other needs. What seems to be clear, not only to American taxpayers, but to the whole world, is that the U.S. military-industrial complex is the only one who benefits most from such aid.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
on Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station. I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Dear listeners, my dear sisters and brothers, welcome to a new episode of Youth Station. Thank you for being with us.
Me? Okay. Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you for being here.
Thank me for being here.
Yeah, how are you?
Alhamdulillah. Can't complain. I'm good.
Why can't you complain? Yes, you can.
Well, I don't think it brings any good. You know, complaining doesn't bring you nothing. You know,
really?
Yeah. You'd rather just get up, you know, move on.
I guess people don't think so right now. Nowadays, people are thinking differently. They complain about every single thing.
I know, right?
Yeah.
And if you make complaining, ranting a part of yourself, no matter where you stand in society, no matter where you stand in your own life, you're still going to carry on doing that, right?
Yeah.
If you're complaining about everything and you're poor, right, financially.
Economical issues.
Yeah. Like, I'm not looking down on poor people because I might be one of those people.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying.
Yes. everyone can be.
Yeah, everyone can be. But if you are that person, even if you're a billionaire, you'd be complaining about how Gucci run out of that purse stock that you
want. So
wanted.
We always have a reason to complain.
Exactly. You'll find a reason to complain if that makes that if that has become a part.
There's always a way to find that.
Yeah.
As human beings. But, you know, throughout the history of human beings, we could see that the concept of good and bad has changed.
Yeah, as in complaining was bad.
Actually, cultures.
They play a big role in that too, right? Because in some cultures...
What about education?
What do you mean?
I mean, in past, maybe people didn't know about many things. But right now, they all go to universities and they read books, perhaps, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to feel like they have to find something to complain about.
Yeah.
Actually, we're not talking about complaining, but as an example, it got through the way.
Yeah, okay, that's a good example. In a certain culture, complaining per se might not be as bad as it is in another culture, right?
Yeah, I get it.
In one culture, complaining might be the way to start a conversation, right? Oh, how have you been? Oh, don't even ask me, you understand? And they just go on and keep on ranting.
That's very familiar
about things,
to me,
you understand, right? And in another culture, like, no matter, like, what you're going through, you have to be like, oh, yeah, everything's good. And you have to have this face and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so it's clear from the appearance of society.
Yeah. So if, as you said, like things have changed, good and bad has changed, that might play a role in
the concept of good and bad being changed has got a relation with culture.
To an extent. Not absolutely, but yeah to an extent, right?
What about morality? But before we get into morality, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So we are talking about the concept of good and bad, which has been changed throughout time. I said about
education, right? You mentioned education and that, and like how times have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the days, if I was there, I'm like back when social media and like televised broadcasting wasn't television.
When technology was not this improved.
Technology, there we go. Wasn't as widespread as it is right now.
Yeah.
The good and evil in cultures might have stayed within those cultures and like might have seeped into cultures or societies bordering those places, right?
Yeah.
But now certain things have happened, as I would say, is there's one universal culture, right?
Yeah.
The world has got its own culture now, mm-hmm. and side by side, yeah. right? Besides that, there are individual countries that have, or like areas or continents that have got their own cultures.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so in terms of that, saying that good and evil has changed might be relative, because in a certain society, something was bad, right? It was
yeah,
evil.
Yeah, but right now it's no longer bad.
Why? Because in another society, it was not evil, right? Now that the world has become a universal culture, right? That thing from like the X point of the globe, which was positive, has seeped in.
It has been a spreader to them.
Yeah, that place. So technology might have played a very...
I would say also morality has got a way in this time.
Yeah, okay. So if you're talking about things that have to do with morality, certainly.
Yeah.
Right? Right. Now, morality, you can't even define it anymore.
Exactly. This is the point. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't define it. And we cannot say who's moral and who's immoral.
Oh, I wish we could. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, why do you think, like, you can't define morality anymore? Like, why? Morality for me right now, for example, is something that is so built in within your nature. It's like something about your consciousness.
Intuitively, you have it.
Yeah. Why is it not, why can it not be defined anymore?
Because every single thing that every one of us is doing right now has got a justification for it. We all have a justification for it. And when I give that reason to you, then you might sympathize with me and say, yes, it's true. Who knows what's truth in the eyes of God?
Okay, but like, they are certain things that, well, being Muslims, right? I don't want no offense to people who don't believe in God, whatever. But being a Muslim, there are certain things that are definitely wrong.
The fundamental things,
In the eyes of God, right?
Yeah.
And there are people who'd bring up justifications for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hideous people, horrible crimes. You understand?
Yeah.
And horrible, horrible things that people would do. And some ex-psychologist would say, oh, it goes back to his childhood. Or like, you know, goes, say, come up with this ludicrous idea.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. That. Psychology many times comes to their help. To many people's help.
Yeah,
you know
what I'm saying? Yeah, well, those psychologists have been proven wrong over and over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And no going to say, oh, well, you know, psychology is knowledge. It's a science. And, well, it's true. No, it's not, because it's theories.
No, let's not eradicate it totally.
No,
I would say
they
have revealed something.
Certainly they have. But, like, you can't label
but
one person.
But it can't be a gospel truth.
No, it can't. Yeah. One person specifically, right? Like, if I'm saying psychology, then I have to consider views and theories of other psychologists as well.
Exactly,
you know,
so
it has to be comparative, right?
And there's always someone who's for and some other one who's against.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right? So horrible crimes, right, that are absolutely detrimental to someone's morality, or the world's morality, universal morality, some guys can come up with an excuse, with a justification.
Before, actually, I say we have to go for the break, let me just give you the topic that we're talking about for after the break. I would say there's another reason, which is freedom. But let's go for a break, and then we'll come back to talk about it.
Let's go.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station. We're still here and we're talking about the concept of good and bad, which has been changed throughout time. And we talked about many things, actually, the cultural reasons and then the technology. And also we talked about morality as well. And I just said
freedom.
Under the pretext of freedom.
Freedom like what? Freedom of speech or freedom just in general?
Just in general, under the pretext of freedom, people do many things and then they justify it. And then through the reasons they would bring for me, then I would say, yes, they're right.
Right. But like, how do we define freedom? Like in general, Western philosophers have defined freedom.
See, when you talk about everyday life, there's no philosophy and there's no scientific, I don't know, factual thing that you could bring. People would go for everything as it is.
Fair
when
enough,
I say like, freedom, what comes to a normal, ordinary person's mind
exactly,
is
right.
That just all sort of freedom.
Fair enough. But like, everyone has to define something, right?
Yeah.
When whoever it is, right, be it someone literate, illiterate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But believe it or not, both of them,
right.
When you say freedom,
okay.
They just come to the fact that freedom is actually ranging all different forms of freedom.
All right, fair enough. But like, if you ask them, how do you define freedom? You know, this is actually...
I do whatever I like to do.
All right, fair enough, right? So the question is, do you only have the right to freedom, or everyone else does too?
Everyone has.
Right, fair enough. That's where the definition comes in.
Yeah.
They say that if whatever you do, right,
yeah.
does not take away a certain right of another person...
Mm-hmm.
Within those boundaries, whatever you do is freedom.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So even freedom has boundaries, right?
Yeah.
So whatever I want to do, if that has no boundaries,
uh-huh.
no tab put on there, then, if my freedom is affecting someone else's freedom, then that's not really freedom because...
But they don't think about it.
Exactly, right? So if I'm thinking about my freedom and the person in front of me is also only thinking about his freedom,
mm-hmm.
then there's war.
Yeah.
There's no freedom.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. That's where slavery and prisoners those things come in. Right?
Yeah. Just in order to bring us back to the main topic, which was the concept of good and bad, which has been changed, I would talk about archetypal pattern. In psychology, Jung talked about these archetypal patterns and said, for example, black is for evil. Whenever we think of black, the only thing that comes to our mind is something evil, something dark, something depressive, whatever of these sorts, you know?
Okay.
And then white, every one of us, when we think of white, we remember purity or whatever. These are mm-hmm. the codes that we have them in our mind.
Okay.
So I usually think of...
that's also cultural. I'm going to like interfere, but like that's also cultural.
How come?
Because in certain cultures...
See, no, I'm just giving you the reason. Ever since we're...
Let me answer when you ask me a question. You said, how come? Let me answer how come.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, in certain cultures, red is a sign of happiness. In other cultures, red is a sign of sorrow.
How come?
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. So,
No, there's the majority, and then there's the minority.
No.
See, exceptions don't break the rules.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Exceptions don't. But like,
as in general,
okay.
Black is for darkness, for depression, for evil, for evilness, and things like this. Okay. As in general. So I'm just I just brought this into our topic mm-hmm. just to say that the good and bad are clear. Ever since we're born, mm-hmm. we know what is good and what is bad. And we have it in the Holy Book of Quran also. The path of truth and the path of wrong deeds are shown to us, are given to us as if we know it, as if it runs in our blood, as if we know it intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
But then what happens to us that we ignore it?
Yeah. You see, someone might say, I'm not ignoring anything. You're the one who's ignoring it. Why? Because now the standards have changed.
Yeah.
And what I think is it comes back to morality, right? When when certain people say morality is relative and what pleases me or brings ease to me in whatever manner is my morality,
mm-hmm.
Then... Well, there is no clear definition of morality left anymore, right?
Yes.
So, I think that's the problem.
That's all the time that we have for today. You know, we could still talk a lot about it.
Yeah.
But we just are giving some hints and clues, and that's all, because time is running so fast.
Man. Yeah, well, that's about you, Station, because the train's moving, and, you know.
They should give us more of time. So
I know.
We plead for more time. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I just bid you farewell from me and from Brother Najafi. So, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic